The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 7. My trip to South Dakota was the best summer ever. Now I don't need to go to Mars, because I've been to the Badlands. And I caught a bigger walleye than Dad when we went to the Missouri River. Then I rode my bike through these huge rocks called needles. Ooh, I also saw my first herd of bison, even a fuzzy furry baby one. I can't wait to go back and see more. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
HuntStand is the most popular and functional mobile hunting app on the market. With a variety of base maps to choose from, satellite imagery that is updated every month, the ability to check the weather, know property information, and even catalog your trail cam pics, HuntStand even gives you the ability to import pins and location markers from other mobile apps. Visit HuntStand.com or download wherever you download your apps. Enter discount code SN20 at checkout for 20% off.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Western Rookie Podcast. This is your co-host, Brian Krebs, talking. Dan Matthews is not going to be on this episode. He's got some meetings with his family and a business partner down there in Missouri. So we're going to ride it solo again. Hopefully it turned out well with the episode 58, Branson Krebs, that we ran solo. We're going to do it again. So got a really cool guest in today. His name's Dwayne Sessions. You know, Dwayne and I actually met on the Elk Mountain this last fall out in Montana. He and his brother and a friend were camping, just down the block, you would say, from me and my brother. So we met, we saw each other pretty much every day, Glass and Elk, and started to kind of connect a little bit. And Dwayne has had an extensive history of hunting the West. So super excited to get him on, talk about just elk hunting, archery. He does a lot of fly fishing up in the mountains. That's his real passion. And so we might dabble in some fly fishing content since it's, you know, west of the Missouri. It probably qualifies for the Western Rookie Podcast. So super excited for today's episode. I don't really have a lot of updates for you on the life side of things. It is still snowing here in Minnesota, so shed hunting has been put to a halt. Haven't got out lately to find any antlers. However, Dan and I have finalized our plans. If you listened to the last episode, we are heading southwest in April to find some elk sheds, and so we're probably going to be doing some podcasts from shed camp, so that's exciting. And then application season's upon us, so the elk team is looking at Colorado as a potential state. We're not sure where we're going to elk hunt in the state yet, but archery elk in Colorado is going to be happening this year. So we might be applying, or we might do over the counter. So we'll keep you posted as I learn more on that front. And that's about it. That's about all the updates I have for you today. And I see that Dwayne has logged in and is waiting in the lobby. So I'm going to pull him in here and we'll fire this episode off.
You're listening to The Western Rookie, a hunting podcast full of tips, tricks, and strategies from seasoned Western hunters. There are plenty of opportunities out there. We just need to learn how to take on the challenges.
Hunting is completely different up there.
I harvested 26 big game animals.
You can fool their eyes, but you can't fool their nose.
300 yards back to the road turned into 3 miles back the other way.
It's always cool seeing new hunters go and harvest an animal.
I don't know what to expect.
If there's anybody I want in the woods with me, it'll be you.
Dwayne, got you in the podcast. How's it going today, bud?
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Just enjoying some snowy weather and hanging out, trying to find stuff to do.
Yeah, I'm in that same boat. We're getting dumped on again today, another 6 to 10 inches. It's pretty much put a cease to all shed hunting, which sucks. And
yeah,
as I was getting set up, I was kind of wondering about you, and I was thinking, I wonder if Dwayne is getting more excited for like application season and elk hunting, or is he just solely focused on fly fishing?
Man, I've been kind of cooped up. My daughter, she played basketball this year, and so I've been kind of chasing that around and really haven't had a chance to get out with the fly rod. And so I'm really chomping at the bit to do that. I mean, this time of year, especially once March hits, fly fishing takes over for me.
Yeah. I will say, I've never fly fished at all. I love fishing, but to me, I love hunting way more. And when I was looking at your Instagram page just a little bit ago, it's like, I think you're at like a 5-to-1 fish to animal ratio. So would you say fly fishing is like the number one on your list?
Yeah. Just mostly because that the season is longer for me, you know. I mean, I'll even take breaks just once archery season's over. You know, October, November, if the weather holds out good and flow levels on some of these rivers are good. I mean, that I'll take breaks from rifle hunting to fly fish. And, even archery season, like I hunted Colorado, early in archery season this last year. And, I took my fly rod with me. You know, there were a couple of days it was slow, it was hot. And, you know, I just went down through on a pair of Chacos and climbed in the river and caught fish.
I'm such a newbie when it comes to trout and fly fishing. Is that something that you would like cook up at elk camp then and like eat the fish you catch, or does it not
taste? Mostly for me with fly, I don't particularly enjoy eating trout. You know, I guess it's more I enjoy torturing them with a hook and then sticking them back in the water.
Yeah.
But you know, here and there, you know, I'll keep one, and you know, and I have done it, especially backpacking in the summer. You know, I'll get up to some of those high mountain lakes and I'll go ahead and keep a couple and, you know, cook them over fire or whatever, just, you know. But no, I don't eat a lot of trout. I just like catching them.
Yeah. You know, it's probably one of those things where a guy should get more into it, because every 8-9 day elk hunt we've ever done, there's always like one day where you're like not feeling like you want to peak the mountain. And so at least if you brought a fly rod, you could be doing something fun versus just sitting in your bunk.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, you know, up there, you know, where I met you last year, you know, you know, there's some creeks and stuff that are running through that area that, you know, you're not going to find like big fish in there, but there's brook trout and stuff in there. And if I do have to eat a trout, a lot of times, you know, one of those smaller brook trout is probably my favorite. You just stick it on a stick and roast it.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose depending on how deep you are, how long ago you ran out of food, I bet that brook trout starts tasting really good.
Yeah.
If you're hungry enough. Which I did want to mention, kind of talk about how we met. So you know, you and I, we met last year in elk camp just by chance. Yep. Like we didn't go to the same hunt. We just found out we were camping next to each other and hitting the same glassing spots most days. And eventually, you know, I feel like it's probably however you meet someone hunting, you're kind of like pretty cautious at first. Like, yeah, we're hunting kind of over there. And then once we started to, I mean, we're seeing each other almost every day. Eventually we figured out, okay, like those guys just hunt over there. We've never been over there. We're hunting over here, not too much overlap. So then it was kind of more fun to kind of be a little bit more open about like what we've been seeing, Or in the case of last year, what we haven't been seeing was usually the story of the day. But I did want to give a huge shout out. So if it wasn't for Dwayne here and his brother, me and my brother would very likely still be packing jacks and parts up the mountain. Because we had some technical difficulties. We popped a Ranger tire on probably one of the worst roads we have ever used to elk hunt. Vertical, steep, rocks, dugouts, and washouts. And that's where we popped a tire right at last light, right as a thunderstorm was rolling in. And so we made a quick decision to bust it down that hill. We actually took the way I think you guys typically go up. We got off trail. We tried to cut some distance off of it, but we were basically diving off a cliff in the dark that we've never done before. And got back to camp, and luckily there Dwayne and his brother were having a beer on the fire and had two four-wheelers, and we asked if we could borrow one and go up there and take the spare off or take the tire off, bring it to town, and then use the four-wheeler again to bring it up. And actually, is Ken your buddy? Is that his name?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Ken actually found your four-wheeler on his way out, and he was going to say, oh, I'll just bring it out for everyone so no one has to make a fourth trip. And I didn't know where to put your key, so I just kept it in my pocket. But otherwise, he could have brought your four-wheeler out for you. So,
Yeah, that was, I don't know. That's one of the cool things to me, with elk camp like that. You know, there's definitely those guys, they're super – they're super secretive. They're super cautious about, what they're, but if you find somebody that, you run into somebody that personality wise, you do well with, it's nice having, we didn't like go hunt together or anything like that, but we kind of got to the point where we were just kind of checking in with each other and making sure we knew where everybody was going to be. And then that way, like in the evening, because even that night, we'd noticed that you guys hadn't come out yet. And, we were like, well, maybe they got something down, but, it's nice to have those open lines of communication, especially back in a place like that, where, even in good conditions, it's a haul to get out of there.
Yeah.
And, so, it's nice having people around, that, we weren't in each other's business, but we knew where each other was at so that we could, kind of have that safety net.
Yeah. It's kind of nice. It's kind of like a community aspect to elk hunting, right? Where it's like, I don't sleep in your house, but I know if I need help, I know where I can knock on a door. And in that particular place, I feel like that's almost a rarity, because we see all the other people that kind of hunt in that general mountain, and we're like, we're not going to get along with that group. Like the way they are operating and what they're doing, especially the year before we met, we were there for rifle season.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's rough up there.
Yeah.
I understand it to a point. There's a lot of locals around that are very protective of, their secret spot that we all know about. And, and they just, they're almost kind of standoffish if you're not a local. And I get it, but, I don't agree with it, but I understand where they're coming from.
Yeah. I don't even know if it was more so standoffish. I'm sure some people were. Once somebody actually found my spotting scope, it bounced off my four-wheeler on that really bad road. And then I went around that entire area that night asking every camp. And eventually I found the people back on the mountain the next hunt. And I was like, hey, by the way, did you find my spotting scope? Because you were up here yesterday. And he goes, yeah, it's back at camp. Follow me out and I'll give it back to you. And I was like, sweet. But it's more so, I think, we are elk hunters that happen to have a four-wheeler and we use it as a tool. I think a lot of people in that valley are off-roaders that happen to have a rifle.
Right.
And that was the difference that really frustrated us, is opening day, you're hearing more ATVs and side-by-sides hitting the red line than gunshots.
Yep.
And so we're like, maybe not anymore for rifle, but we'll come back for bow. And then we met you. And then we actually met that cowboy who was hilarious.
Yeah.
And the next day after you basically saved us, he came knocking and was like, hey, I buried my truck. Like, I can't get out of this little place where I'm camping. And so we had to pull him out too. And he was buried. There's no way. It was going to be a long walk up and over the ridge to get back to his headquarters to get some help for him.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, no, ironically, right before we popped that tire, I had a cow at 60 yards and I was really looking like we were locked. So I could have probably slowly drawn and shot, but what I couldn't really do was like make sure I had a good range and they were open right. country. And so I was like, I just don't feel like I want to push the limit. 60's already a long ways, and then 60 yeah. without a guaranteed range, like a solid range and adjustment, it's not a yeah. shot that's favoring me as the hunter yeah. anymore. So we got into a big herd. My brother saw that day, he saw about a three, he thinks it's mid threes, and he's seen a lot of bulls, so I believe him. And because I let out a bugle and we hear a response about 300 yards away, just like you do, right? Just elk hunting. Yeah. And so we're looking, and, you know, usually it's kind of funny because once you've done it enough, you know, like, don't just take off. Like, pull up the map, check the wind. Okay, we think he's here. Let's do this. Well, all of a sudden, he bugled again, and he had cut the distance in half in about 10 seconds. And so we're like, oh, crap. This is not good. He's above us about 100 feet. He's coming fast. And so we just try to run. Well, sure enough, deadfall. Like, we're in the middle of deadfall.
Yeah.
And so we both trip and fall, and we make it all of about 10 feet, and he's there. Full herd, huge bull. Turns out a different hunter jumped him and his herd tracking his bull. And it just was coincidence that I bugled, but he was gonna run over us anyway. So he winded us. We had bad thermals, and he was above us, and we had no time to move. But we saw that big bull. I think it's probably a big bull that you guys had also been seeing.
Yeah, it probably was. There was one real good bull, and then there were a couple others that were. I mean, they were decent bulls, but I don't. You know, when it comes to those bulls and I've got a bow in my hand, I'm not real picky.
No, I was about to shoot the raghorn that he was with. He was at 50 and he went behind a tree, and I was at pulling back to like get him on the other side. And right as he was behind that tree was when everything kind of caught our wind at that moment. That raghorn, I think, blew through our wind because he was going so fast and he wasn't as smart, but the lead cows and that big bull caught our wind and everything locked up and just took off, which was a bummer. It's cool to be close, but that whole day, like, we were in them, and then right at last light I almost shot that cow. And then thinking back, like, oh my gosh, what if we would have popped that tire at, like, looking back, seeing that thunderstorm came through after dark, and then we would have still been quartering and packing, and then we would have had it would have been a survivable ordeal, but it would have been a real bummer.
Yeah.
So, glad it kind of worked out the way it did.
Yeah, for sure. That was a bad spot, we were just happy that we were there to help you guys out of that, because that could have been bad.
Yeah, it was kind of funny. We did go home that night, and we were like, man, I don't know. Dwayne's brother didn't really seem so hot on that idea. Like, we're a little worried. And then the next morning, your brother's like, dude, I am so sorry. I heard the whole conversation from the bathroom. I thought my brother already said yes. I didn't realize he said, I'll ask my brother. And I didn't mean to be such a dick. And we're like, oh, we didn't think you were a dick, but we were a little bit worried. Like,
yeah. Cause he comes out and he's kind of standing around there, and we're kind of telling him what happened. And it was just kind of like this uncomfortable silence. And I'm like, really? You're not going to let him use it, you know? And then he's like, oh, I thought you already said they could.
Yeah. It was a real big sigh of relief when he said that the next morning, because we kind of left it at like, well, we'll check in the morning. And then we knew that the cowboy had that real old raggedy solid axle four wheeler. And that was like our next option was like, I bet he's not using that.
Yeah. That would have been a bad one to take up that road too, because that solid axle, that's a road that you crack that axle.
Yeah, it's bad. It is bad. And we thought about it. Like, my dad has a carbon copy Ranger of my brother's, so we should have just put it up on blocks and took the front and rear tire off of it and brought them with the spares.
Yeah,
that's something that definitely we need to add to our system for sure. But
yeah,
I was listening to some of your podcasts that you've done with other people, and it sounds like your style, maybe just the style of those two bulls that were on the podcast were different, but it sounded like you're very comfortable spotting and stocking elk with your bow versus calling them into you.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in an area where you don't have a ton of pressure, I'm okay with just trying to get as close as I can without making sound. I do like to get out, in the mornings, if I'm out there in the morning, because that area we were hunting over there, we do a lot of, we get up in the morning, a lot of mornings, and go up in glass and try to find elk. But if I'm already up there, if they've been regularly in a certain area several days in a row, I'll go hit it in the morning and maybe hit like a locator bugle or something just to kind of get a feel for where they're at, and then, like you said, you kind of figure out what the wind's doing, what the thermals are doing, and just kind of push it close and see if you can find them. And sometimes you got to hit a few cow calls or something to try to relocate them again. But I spot and stalk, I have no problem with.
Do you, if it's open country like we were in, I feel like that spot's kind of weird because it's not that high elevation to have like a tree line. And then even the trees aren't that thick. And so I feel like it's kind of a unique spot. Is that usually where you start to do more spot and stalk when it's like kind of that more open country? You're probably going to get windowed anyway, or very likely you're going to get windowed if you try to call them into you.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And that's the thing that's the thing with open country too. If you're out there and you're doing a lot of calling and stuff, especially with that particular area, I mean, all they really have to do, because you've got these timbered slopes, and then the opposite slope is completely bare. Mm-hmm. And so, if you're kind of working your way up this open slope, I mean, they can see you from that timber. And so if you start calling, they're looking over there and they're not seeing an elk. And so a lot of times they'll either just sit tight or they'll just blow out the top. But whereas if you've kind of got a general idea of where they're at, I mean, you could, I'll do a lot of times where I'll see them go into the timber and I'll slip up the bottom of that drainage, and hope the wind holds out, and I'll just sit, pretty close to where I saw them go in the timber, and wait for them to make a sound. That can be an all day thing, but that a lot of that comes from like you guys in the Midwest with whitetail hunting and stuff, sitting in a tree stand. I've done a lot of that. When I lived in Oklahoma, and so for me, I can sit there all day. Yeah. I have no problem. If I'm pretty confident that they're there, I'll sit all day and not make a sound, and wait for them to get up and start moving around and making noise again, and then I'll decide how I'm going to approach it.
Yeah, but, it's kind of,
there's a lot of guys out west here that they don't have a lot of experience just sitting all day, and they want to push that issue, and it usually doesn't go good, just because, like I said, the way the terrain is there, with the timber on that, on that kind of north side, and then the opposite slope being wide open, you're gonna get busted, and going through that timber, even though it's it's fairly open, there's most of it, there's not a ton of like bad deadfall, but it's still, it's hard to be quiet moving through there. And then, you know, when you trip over them, I mean, they know you're there.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a different unit. You know, we're used to more black timber for sure. And, yeah. And yeah, that's kind of funny. You make the correlation to like whitetail hunting. We just had Ryan Carter on the podcast last week, and I'm sure you know him based on other people you know. And he said the same thing. He's like, I actually kind of just started putting together my whitetail patterning techniques with trail cameras and loops and just started applying it to elk hunting. And then he obviously uses a lot of tree stands because he's hunting like very early season, you know, summer pattern stuff. And so, yeah, I like what you say. And I think it, you know, that unit, I think between the unit and the year we had last year, it was just a weird combination because it's a lot of elk, but they weren't very vocal for whatever reason. And I heard that across a lot of the West last year. I don't understand how it could be the same thing like states away where it's like middle, third week of September and we can't buy a bugle. And so I definitely think that's where you might just have to change your tactics up. Like you said, you know, if I get eyes on a herd and I put them to bed or close to, you know, pushing the issue is going to maybe blow that one. It might take you 3 days to get on another, you know, small batch of elk. And so if you want to push that issue, push your issue when you got bulls going off everywhere. And it's like, okay, if we blow this one, we got another one 600 yards away. We can go chase.
Yep. And I've hunted that area like that too. I mean, you know, that's the nice thing about, you know, that area. If you, you know, if you've got someplace where you can get up, you can glass those elk and you can kind of see what they're doing. You know, I honestly like to, my preference is to spend a day or two glassing before I try to make a move on them, you know, but I've got that time.
Yeah.
You know, there's some guys that, you know, they've got, you know, 5 days, they got to get in there and get it done. And so, you know, they'll try to make adjustments on the fly and it works out. I mean, but you know, there's been years, you know, same area. I've actually killed two bulls up there within probably 100 yards of each other, 2 years in a row. And the first year, we called the bull in and, you know, almost every morning it was just, you know, they were just going off, you know, right before daylight. And so our strategy was, well, we're not going to waste time glassing. We're going to get up here where we know they've been and we're going to call them and, you know, and move, call and move, call and move. And, you know, to try to get the wind and everything in our favor. And then the next year, I mean, we weren't hearing anything. And, but again, you know, that general area, I think the day I shot that bull, we'd watched him and a couple others the night before. And so that next morning I was like, well, let's just get after it. And, you know, we slipped in there and, you know, and it took most of the day to find where he was, but, you know, it was kind of still hunting, you know, kind of work our way around and, you know, we just happened to spot him, you know, bedded down below a tree. And we'd actually, like, the day had gone so slow, probably 10 minutes before we saw him, we'd called, you know, like 30 yards away from where we'd seen him. You know, we kind of set up, you know, did some calling and it was just absolute silence. And we just happened to catch a glimpse of him as we were kind of still hunting our way back through some timber. And, you know, and then I just, you know, I put together a plan and stalked on him, put a stalk on him and lucked out.
Yeah. Was that a bull that was like satellite bull?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I've had the same exact thing happen in a different part of Montana. Me and a buddy, you know, we're walking through and it was like a slow day. And we're probably moving too fast, but we weren't even on elk. I mean, we're basically doing a glorified scouting mission. And we go through this patch of woods, and there's all of a sudden we just both stop, and it's like we got T-boned by a scent, right? And you're like, there's elk here. And so we slow up, and we find a patch of fur. Like, we find this bull bedded at 40 yards above us. And it must have been a cold, rainy day because the thermals were going down. And And we tried to cow call. We were putting up glass, trying to make sure he was legal. Finally figured out he was legal. We're doing a cow. I mean, 40 yards, it's like, man, we're not set up to be doing calling. So, like, we didn't really get too aggressive. Well, then our other two happened to meet us. Like, they came in, like, 30 yards below us. So now we are set up great. Like, we're perfect. They're 70 yards from the bull. We're 40. They can't see. The bull can't see him. He's bedded behind these trees. We can only see patches of fur. And, man, we had play signals. Like, I joked that we should get these quarterback arm straps so we can be like, you know, do 2-4 or 2-0. But we got all the hand signals. And so we're like, you know, ramp it up, cow call, bugle, you know, give the bugle, give the chuckles. That bull didn't even care. 40 yards away. Didn't care at all. No peep. And so I think it's just you got to keep that in mind because a lot of people see Corey Jacobson run around on ridges and bugle, and they bugle back, and then he shoots them. And that's great. It works for sure. But what you didn't see is the 100 bugles he ripped without a response and all the elk he runs by. And he will say, like, yeah, I run by elk all the time because I want to interact with one. I don't want to kill one.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's like not every bull in the woods is going to answer your call.
No. No. There's sometimes it's kind of you're just lucky that anything's talking, you know, and especially when you know, the area that, you know, where we met, you know, you don't have, you know, like the wolf pressure and stuff like that, but you get over closer to Yellowstone Park and, you know, and those units around, there, and there's a lot of times, you know, guys, they won't hear a bugle in a week. You know, and you know, they're in elk every day, but they're not talking because of the predator situation.
Yeah, and that's kind of, we've hunted some gravelies, which is, I think it's a mountain range off the park, but it's still kind of part of that greater Yellowstone ecosystem, was what they said.
Right. Yeah.
Bears and wolves for sure. I mean, we saw grizzlies. And we've actually had decent bugling in there. The reason we left is because we had a couple encounters that were a little close for comfort with grizzlies. And one year we were there, there was like 5 maulings in our valley the week we were there.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was the year that all the beef cows ate the wrong flower and died. Like a whole herd died. And so there was, I think they counted like 29 bears in this area.
Yeah, it was nuts. The amount of maulings they had. I mean, and, you know, there was like, I think there were 2 maulings where they attributed it to the same bear, and they were like 5 miles apart. You know, where they were from. You know, the one guy got hit, and then, you know, like 2 days later, 5 miles away, another guy gets mauled by. And I think they said it was the same bear.
Right. Yeah. It was scary. They shut down half of a mountain, like a big mountain. They said, like, everything west of here is shut down. Do not go in there.
Yeah.
Too many bears. We were hunting the other side of that mountain. And so halfway through the week, somebody got enough cell reception to check the news. And they were like, and so we're like, oh, man, there's a lot of bears here. But then we're like, well, they're all over there, so we should be safe. Well, then halfway through the week, they're like, all right, all the bears went home. You guys can come hunt here, which obviously meant they went up and over back into our side. And we, going home, we stopped at a newspaper or a gas station, saw a newspaper, and it said, you know, mauling number 3 or whatever it was that week, you know, 1 mile up Fishhook Creek. I don't know what the creek was. And I'm like, Ben, didn't you kill a bull? Wasn't your bull like 1 mile up Fishhook Creek? And he's like, yeah. And he pulls up the map, and the chunk of woods was small, like 200 acres comparatively, like pretty small woods. And so it's like, oh, like goosebumps, right? Like, there's a good chance your kill, like your carcass, was what that bear was there for, and then someone else got mauled. You know, how could you know? But it still gave us enough goosebumps. We're like, let's look for other places in Montana.
Yeah. Yep. I really, because, you know, I do like, typically like 10 to 14 days with my brother during archery season, but the rest of archery season, a lot of times I'm by myself. And, I guess there's some naivety to me, and, And so my wife has more common sense about that than I do. And she really encouraged me to stay away from those, grizzly areas. And, but so I'll go check out a couple other spots where, the population isn't as prevalent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's basically where we got to. Two guys in our group, they're kind of like last minute tag alongs. They're not really part of the group, but we kind of said, if you want to camp with us, we can point you to some spots or whatever.
Right.
They came up on a bear kill, or I don't know. It was a carcass hidden, buried, like logs and stuff. Like, it was obvious a bear was like protecting this carcass. And then we saw a grizzly like 300 yards from our four wheeler. And they texted us and said, it's like last light. Me and my brother are hunting. And we get a text message and says, hey, just FYI, we saw a bear like 300 yards from your four wheeler, kind of in between you and the four wheeler. And we're like, oh. And so we look at each other and like, you want to see how fast we can sprint back to the four wheeler and see if we can make it before dark? And he's like, yep. Yeah. And so we just run. We're basically running off this mountain, racing the sun, looking for bears, like, bear spray out kind of thing. And it gets dark right before we get there. And we know where we are. We're like within 100 yards of the four wheeler. So you're starting to be like, oh, we made it. And a coyote goes off like 10 yards from us in the woods, like the last strip of black timber. And we both lost a pair of underwear at that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you're just, your nerves are so on edge in a situation like that, that, like, even though it's a coyote, you're like, you can convince yourself that it's more than that.
Yeah. It wasn't even like that. It was just like, we had a finger on a hair trigger, and it's like, we didn't know it was a coyote at first. We just heard this loud ass noise right next to us when we're thinking bear. Right. And then it's like, oh, it was just coyote. Like, but still, man, we lost a pair of underwear on that one. And so that was kind of just added up, right? Five people got mauled. We saw bears by camp. Elk hunting wasn't phenomenal. It was good, not great. Let's go find a different place to hunt. And that's what led us. I mean, we looked at the map and started over. Like, where should we possibly go? And that's, we landed on the unit that you and I met in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, to be fair, that unit has some frustrations, but we've seen more and bigger elk in that unit for a general unit than anywhere else we've hunted.
Yeah. No, it's a good unit. As you get later into archery season and you get more guys coming in there, the pressure kind of, they've got some pretty good little escape routes that, they're gone, and you're done with those elk. But the nice thing is it's usually a couple of days and they'll kind of filter back in.
Yeah.
And so, if you've got the time again, some guys don't have that time, but if you've got the time to hang out and if you enjoy glassing, eventually it seems like they always come back in after a couple of days.
Yeah, and it seems like that unit is a good unit to test your adaptability as an elk hunter.
Yeah.
For sure. Like, if you have a lot of tools in your tool bag as an elk hunter, you can call, maybe you bring in a mobile tree stand setup, you know how to hunt sign or pass, like still hunt, stock, glass. Like, I feel like that's a good unit for someone that's real versatile. If you're like a one trick pony, you just got to hope that the elk are in the mood for that one trick.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So, I've heard you mention it twice now. You got a lot of time. And then obviously when we were talking, last fall, I kind of got an insight to just to how much time you do have. But tell people kind of like how you were able to build, like, structure this life that you're able to hunt 14 days with your brother and then send him back to work and then keep going after that.
Well, my wife is super smart. When we were young and first married, she was almost done with school. I still had some time left, and you know, I was like, well, you know, she got a great job offer. It would have been stupid to pass it up. And so I was like, I'll just finish school wherever we land. Well, you know, by the time that school year was over, and you know, we were expecting our first child, and we'd gone down, and we were in Louisiana, and I was like, well, how would it be if I just stayed home with the kids? And she was like, really? And I was like, yeah, how hard can it be? You know, and then so the rest is kind of history. I mean, that our first daughter was born, and I remember sitting there, you know, the day that my wife had to go back to work, and I'm sitting there with this child, and I'm like, I'm looking at her and going, all right, what are we gonna do? And you know, I was just like, I'm just gonna do what I like to do, and I'm gonna take, you know, and I'll throw her in a backpack, and we'll go do, you know, we'll go fishing, we'll go hiking, we'll do all this stuff, and you know, and so I pretty much raised my kids and eventually got to the point where I had some freedom. You know, I could start heading out and doing some of these longer hunts. You know, and I got into archery, you know, probably about 15 years ago, maybe a little bit more than that. But anyway, I just, she does really good. And when we moved to Colorado, I got a job. You know, they were getting older, you know, I've only got one left at home now. So I took a job as a fly fishing guide. And then, the outfitter I was working for, he ran hunts in the fall too. And so I started doing that and you know, kind of got into the industry a little bit and you know, met some super cool people and you know, I've just had a lot of flexibility because my wife's smart. That's what it comes down to.
Well, it's not that you're not smart, because you're an electrical engineer on paper, right? All right, so I think we broke up a little bit when we got you back. And so I think it's funny you said, like, my wife is just smart, but you're also an electrical engineer on paper, right? So it's not like you're not smart. Yeah.
No, I mean, what makes me smart is I married a smart chick.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the real strategy there. And so that's kind of what I did. I married a pharmacist, and I'm also an electrical engineer. So you've given me a little bit of a roadmap maybe to work towards.
Yeah.
But was it when you were guiding, is that when you really developed your love for horses and mules?
Something like that. Yeah. After you get tossed off a horse a few times and bitten and I really enjoy how stubborn they are. You know, it's got a place in my heart.
Yeah. I think you mentioned while we were hunting in Glass, and if I never have to ride a horse again, I'll be happy.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got some buddies that, you know, they'll do like horseback pack trips and stuff in the summer, and I'm like, I'll walk. there was one day where, you know, we were hauling a pack string out, and we needed pack saddles on the horse that I normally rode to haul some clients back in. And they were like, you know, are you okay walking out? And I'm like, yes, please. And I actually ended up, I left camp like probably about 15 minutes after they had taken off with the pack string. And I passed them right before we got back out to the trailhead. It was a couple miles, you know, of trail. I'm much more comfortable on my own feet versus having to trust the horse. They just don't like me.
Yeah.
I don't know.
My brother's the same way. And he says, I just don't like horses. I think the real secret is he never learned how to ride them, and he just smashes his nuts every time.
Well, I spent that year that I guided wilderness area hunts, you know, horseback hunts, I mean, I was on a horse. I was looking at it one day, and it had been like 32 days straight that I'd been on a horse, you know, for whether it was hunting or, you know, going out and hauling supplies in or whatever. And I still never developed a love of horses.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting take. I mean, I look at a horse and be like, man, if I had a horse, all the shed hunting I could do or all the places I could go. But then you hear all these busted up cowboys that, you know, fell off these horses. And I'm like, well, I just wouldn't do what you're doing. But then you hear, then I met you and you're like, I was literally doing everything I could possibly do to not get bucked off. And it still happened.
Yeah, for sure. I just, they don't like me. Well, and part of the problem is too, is like an outfitter, typically he doesn't have, you know, like those cowboys that were up there pushing cows when we were, you know, while we were hunting.
Yeah.
Your typical outfitter, he doesn't have a horse like that.
Yeah.
You know, he's got some, you know, some broke freaking, you know, horse that he bought from from some place where they do trail rides, you know, and they throw somebody on that horse for a couple miles and then they come back and, you know, that horse is made to walk up that trail and then walk back down that trail. And if you want them to do anything other than that, they're cantankerous.
Yeah, they're like the horses that those cowboys didn't want.
Right. Yeah, exactly. They're the horses that those cowboys would send to the dog food factory.
Yeah. Great horse. Got a great horse. It's only $500. And you're like, oh, shit.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. It was pretty impressive we just saw a little bit of those cowboys working. But I remember just busting it one day to the very top. We walked from the bottom of the top. It's not like that big a deal, but you're definitely like a little winded when you get up there and you look and there's a guy on a horse in some country and you're like, holy crap. Like, I don't know how he got up there on that horse, but I would not be comfortable with that.
Right. Yep.
And then to chase cows down, like getting up's the easy part. Chasing the cows down is the real fun.
Yeah. And they're like, I mean, they're not just slowly walking this horse down, you know, down through, I mean, it's some pretty steep terrain and they're running those horses, you know, to catch cows trying to cut back or whatever. And like, I am not that much of a horseman.
Yeah. And that's where I kind of think, like, if I ever did get animals for Western hunting, the llamas are starting to look better and better.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, I'm still going to walk, I'm not going to ride, but they're going to carry all the weight. They feed themselves,
right. Basically. That's a huge, especially if you're doing, you know, like a backpack hunt.
Yeah.
You know, being able to take and, you know, put, you know, 60 pounds or whatever on a llama, I mean, you know, you're just carrying your boat. I mean, it's awesome.
Yeah, literally. And then if you have a couple more for, like, if you shoot an elk, or even at that point, like when, I think one thing people really forget about when you hunt deep that I've talked to anyway, they're like, oh, that's so deep. Like, imagine getting an elk out of there. I'm like, you just break it up. Like, you know,
right.
I would rather do twice the trips on half the pack. Right. And if you have llamas, like, what's the big deal? Like, just make three trips with your llama. Yeah. If you don't have any weight on you, you could probably do all three of those trips in a long day or like two easy days.
Right.
Like we're getting back to camp for happy hour each day type of a day. And then it's like, it's nothing to walk 5-10 miles a day in the mountains if you don't have that weight.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. And I mean, you know, like the first trip out, you know, you know, you haul whatever you can meat wise. And then, you know, and once you get back to camp, you're also dumping an extra 10 pounds, you know, in bow. And, you know, so you know, once you shift into that mode of, you know, you're just hauling meat out, you know, you can streamline your pack pretty quickly to where you're just hauling meat. And, you know, and so you walk in, you're empty, you know, come back out with a full load and just do what you can. know, there's a lot of guys that they'll pack on 100 pounds and, you know, or so, and try to do it all in one trip. And, you know, and that's great. But, you know, as I'm getting older, I'm like, I'd rather just throw a couple extra trips in. You know, it's a nice walk in and come out heavy.
Yeah. Especially the walk in, man. When you're in pack mode, you basically got your water bladder, a trekking pole, and your backpack. Like, so the walk in, you're like 4 pounds, maybe.
Right.
It's beautiful. The walk out sucks. I mean, I've done everything. I've done everything from half of a mule deer, half of a small mule deer, which is like probably less than some of my day packs I've packed up for a hunt, really.
Yeah.
All the way up to about 175, 180. And I'll tell you, there's a sweet spot. And it's not like, you know, my name is Brian and my sweet spot is X. It's like how I'm feeling today, the training I did this summer. You know, that year I was doing 175, 180. I had also lost 60 pounds, worked my tail off doing double headers. I went through a breakup, and I found it's really easy to get in shape when you go through a breakup. And and I drew a once in a lifetime tag. So I left my pack frame at the gym, and I'd put plates on it after my weightlifting and then go hit the stair climber. With the stair climber, I really only got to 2 plates, but on a treadmill, I'd get to 3 plates, three and a half plates. And so I knew I could do it, right? And I did the front and rear, and I walked out pretty clean. And that was 146. I weighed that without the pack, just the meat and bones weighed 146. When I got to the head and the neck, and I left way too much neck on the head, the hide was wet. I saved enough hide to mount 2 bulls, and then the antlers. And the way it got on my pack, not only was it 175 when I weighed it, but it was also such a mismanaged weight where, like, the balance was all off, and I had to stand at basically a 90, you know, feet up, bent over to balance it. And that's where it's like I hit a hard wall. That I couldn't do that anymore. Like the 146 when it was weighted nice is fine. And I did the entire bull in one day. I've done 5 trips at this point. But that head, it crossed that threshold. Yeah. It's like if you can just keep under that, you can move so much faster.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my strategy. And I'm a bigger dude. I mean, I'm not a huge guy, but I'm not a small person either. So for me to do like an 80 or 100 pound pack is the equivalent of like my brother doing that 60 pound pack. Cause he's just a smaller guy than I am.
Yeah. It depends on, you know, I mean, there's other factors too. Like, you know, if you're only having to go a mile, I'm just going to make myself miserable, you know, and we're going to get this, you know, if I've got another guy with me, you know, I take the time. I've gotten to the point where I really prefer to take the time to just go ahead, you know, and break it down, get it off the bone. And, you know, once you do that, I mean, you know, it's doable with two guys to get that thing out a mile or two. You know, and it's still freaking heavy, but it's doable. You know, when you start getting into that, you know, 5 miles, 10 miles, things like that, it's smarter to do it in multiple trips. It just is, you know, for the majority of people, you know, just from the standpoint of saving your body.
Yeah.
You know, if you load that thing up and hurt yourself coming out, you know, with that whole elk, then you're having to drop it anyway and make multiple trips hurt.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just not worth it.
Yeah. And especially when you start talking like a longer pack out, the longer your pack out is, the better chances you're going uphill and downhill. Like you're going up and over, up and over, up and over. And that's when that weight really starts to eat you alive. Versus like if you're talking a 1 mile pack out, that usually means it's kind of a straight line. We just got to go down, hit this road.
Yeah.
Then we can dump it. Yeah. And we might have a 4 mile around to get the four wheeler or get the truck. But that's empty, and that doesn't matter. Yeah. That's free.
And that's another reason I like that area up there where we met is, you know, even if you've got your four-wheeler, you know, or whatever, even if it's sitting back at camp, you know, you can get that meat to someplace and drop it, and it's going to be, you know, it's going to be safe enough while you get back to camp and get that four-wheeler to come up and pick it up. You know, there's some roads there that kind of intersect in good spots that, you know, I don't necessarily like to drive up them, you know, when I'm hunting, but, you know, once I've got something down, I'll go up and pick it up.
Yeah, that the unit really is, well, I'll put an asterisk on that. Most parts of that unit are really nice mountaineering unit, right? It's easy to navigate. It's easy to get places. Yeah. It's almost too easy because you're like, it's such an open woods that you're probably walking too fast and then you're jumping stuff, right? It's that easy, which kind of can be a double-edged sword, and that's what made calling kind of hard and a lot of things. But we went into a couple places kind of, you know, if you drew a line between our camp and your camp and then went farther back that way, up in there, we got into that stuff, and that was gnarly. That was nasty. Yep. We did like 1 hour loop, and we're like, nope, we're not hunting this.
Yeah, and I mean, I know exactly where you're talking about, and we've spent some time off and on up in there, and you know we've found sign and stuff, but you know the second time I think that I wandered up in there, I mean I was almost scared to call because it was so gnarly up in there. I kind of
didn't want
to
run.
I knew if I got something coming, I was going to shoot it, and then I was going to have to get it out of there.
Yeah. Exactly. And I got a sense that was like a summer spot, because it's dark, it's cooler, there's more water, it's thicker, more blowdown rocks. It was nasty. It just wasn't fun. I felt like that was maybe where older bulls would go in the summer to get out of the heat. But to me, it doesn't strike me as a good rut spot, because if I was a bull, I would want access. Like, I want to move fast. I want to find cows. I want to be able to run easy. And that's kind of where we were hunting. Plus, you know, personally, I went there in rifle season. I did a big loop, big 7 mile loop. And on about mile 5, so I'm about as far away from the four wheeler as possible or the road, I fell through a bog just straight down. I took a solid step, took one more step, and there was no ground. The earth was not there anymore.
Yep, I know exactly where you're talking about up there, and it is. It's
I was not happy. I was relatively unwell mentally at that point in the hunt. This was like day 5. We haven't had anything going this far, and I was just pissed. Now my whole legs are wet. I mean, I never hit bottom. I was just lucky enough that I went like this and put my arms out at goofy angles and caught something hard. My gun went under. You know, I was carrying the Kitfaru underarm thing. That went halfway down. Yeah. And then I had to walk. I mean, it's 30 degrees or 20 degrees, whatever it is, and I still had 2 miles, a solid 2 miles, maybe even 3 miles to get back to the four-wheeler. And it was prime time, and I'm just like, I'm done. I haven't seen as much of a squirrel, let alone an elk. I'm going back to the cabin. Yeah. I'm going to start the supper and take my clothes off and hang them up over the fire.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's kind of – that unit's a goofy one. It seems like that unit's – it's like the unit that doesn't want to play by the rules. It's like
– right.
You think you're going to come here and call elk in? Well – let me throw this at you. Or you think you're just going to glass them and put them to bed? Well, let me throw this at you. They're going to be gone by the time you get there because somebody on a side-by-side just ripped through there.
Right.
So.
Yep. Or you're going to have somebody slip in on the ridge above you and, you know, and as they're coming up over the ridge, they get busted.
Talk on the phone while you're trying to sneak on these elk.
Oh, no. Yeah. Public land hunting.
Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of funny. One thing, speaking of all that, one thing I wanted to touch on. So we were elk hunting, and we went up high one day because we did the Dwayne Sessions plan. We got up, had breakfast, went and glassed, sat in the Ranger, or you sat in the truck, you know, stay warm. But we put some elk to bed, right? We followed some elk. We kind of saw where they went. So they're like, all right, perfect. We're going to go in after them. So we climb up there. But when we were up there, what was kind of interesting was that you were somewhere where you could see us. You could see these two hobos walking around.
Yep.
And tell people what caught your eye.
Your bow.
Yeah, my bow. So my bow is a white camo Matthews. And apparently that thing shined like a neon bar sign up there.
Yep.
And so that's what,
yeah, because we're sitting over there and, you know, and we're kind of waiting to see if something would come up over the top of this ridge. And I just caught a glint, you know, and just caught my eye and I was like, oh, that's Brian's bow.
Yeah. I had it strapped to my pack. And when you said that, I always knew like, I bought it when I was going through a white camo phase in college where I thought white camo was the coolest thing and I was going to buy a truck and make it white camo type of mindset.
Yeah, that's a better phase than some people go through in college these days.
True. Yeah. It wasn't a white line phase. It was a white camo phase. And so I always knew it wasn't optimal, but I didn't think it really mattered that much. But when you said, yeah, I saw your bow from like 2 miles away with my naked eye, I'm like, all right, the next bow is not going to be white camo. That's what kind of really put it in my mind that like this could be an issue now for elk hunting.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't get as obsessive over, you know, over that kind of stuff as, I know guys that they go buy a brand new bow and the first thing they do is they break it down and they rattle can that thing, you know, just because, you know, they're like, you know, this green ambush is too bright.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they'll dull it out a little bit with spray paint. But I do try to get, you know, some of those earth tone colors, but I don't obsess about it to the point that some guys I know do.
Yeah, I don't either. But the white one, that struck me as like, if it's that noticeable to a human, an elk's probably going to look at that and they honestly might look at it and be like, I don't know what that is, but it's not that big of a deal. But I just don't necessarily want them to be like scanning and be like, oh, there he is.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do something. Earth tone, you know, maybe I'll do that Canyon. I don't know. I think I'm going to switch to Hoyt. You guys are shooting Hoyt, right?
No, I actually, I've been shooting Matthews for a couple of years. I'm not married to a brand of bow. I go out and when I'm looking at a new bow, I shoot everything. Mm. You know, I'll shoot a bear if they've got a bear there to shoot, just to see how it feels compared to, you know, the other bows but I've been shooting a Matthews for 3 years, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you shooting a heavy bow?
The one that I have set up for elk season is it's a VXR. So what is that? I think that's 3 or 4 years old. And it's the 31 and a half axle to axle. So, you know, it's the longer bow. But I actually weighed it here the other day. I didn't have my quiver on it, which is, you know, my seven arrow quiver probably puts it, you know, right at 10 pounds.
Yeah.
But without that quiver on there, I was just under eight.
Yeah. I remember you said that, yeah, shoot a 10 pound bow, which seems heavy. I shoot a heavy bow. But that's because I have a pretty good size stabilizer with some weight and I have a back bar that I hunt.
And I've got that.
Yeah. So it adds up.
Yeah, I think I've got a 12 inch stabilizer on the front, and then I've got a 10 inch back bar.
Yeah, I think I'm not to compare sizes, but I think I'm right in there somewhere. And then, are you shooting a lot of weight? Are you shooting a lot of poundage?
So my VXR I've got the 75 pound mods on there.
Okay.
It honestly, you know, the difference between the 70 and 75 isn't that much, but it gives me it gives me the optionality of I can maintain a good speed, you know, because I shoot 150 grain broadheads for elk, and so it gives me the option I can maintain that. You know, I'm right there somewhere between 280 and 285 feet per second, you know, with a heavier broadhead.
Yeah, I recently just switched. I think I'm at like 175 grain, and that's, you know, I wish I could shoot a little faster because I feel like I'm big enough and I work out enough that it, you know, 75, 80 pounds wouldn't be the issue for me. So it'd be nice to get some of that speed back. But it's all like archery is just one of those things where it's almost like it's a journey, not a destination. Like rifle hunting is a destination. Yeah. You build a rifle and it's done. And, but like archery hunting, and I listened to some of the podcasts that you had with Brian, the other Brian, Brian Call, the more famous Brian, and talking about like how you, like you got into it. And then you mean you've done a lot of work on your form and your archery journey yourself. Like what have you found was kind of the biggest impacts to like, not just accuracy, but just being sustainable, like really dialing in the form?
I was fortunate enough to you know, when I met Brian Call, you know, I was fortunate enough to be someplace where there's just, you know, there's an amazing shop. And, you know, and those guys, I mean, they really took me in and helped me work on that form, kind of got me going down the right path. And then, and then they started introducing some different tools. I've got all kinds of stories with hinge releases, you know, send them through my bow, you know, punching myself in the face, you know, things like that. But I haven't been as good about it here lately, but, you know, I try to get out and shoot, and I'm lucky too. I've got a lot of, I kind of live a little bit rural, so I can get out in the backyard and shoot. But, I've got a buddy that, you know, he lived down in Austin in the suburbs for a long time. And, you know, he had like 15 yards where he could shoot down, you know, from his driveway into his garage. And he'd go out and shoot, you know, 24 arrows a day.
Yeah.
And, a lot of it's just repetition. And once you kind of get some instruction on what proper form is, it's recognizing when that form is breaking down. And so, you know, that's where I introduce like a hinge release, because for me, that hinge release really makes me focus on my form to make that shot, you know, break clean. And, you know, and so I basically have, I've got a thumb release and a hinge release that are pretty much they're not the exact same company, but they're very similar dimensions. And so when I'm shooting with that hinge release, then when I pick up that thumb button, you know, I just use that same form. And honestly, if your form's correct, it's going to go off the same way as that hinge release does.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know a lot of guys that you know, they go out, they pull their bow out, you know, a month, 2 weeks before archery season starts, and they go out and they kill elk, and great, you know, good on them. But me personally, I want to be ready, all the time.
Yeah.
And so I put a lot of time into, you know, as I'm walking around, you know, working on the house or whatever, you know, I take a few minutes for lunch or whatever. And I pull the bow out and, you know, I hit the target out there, you know, a lot of times I'll shoot that target, you know, not knowing exactly what the range is and just seeing, cause that's another good thing to do too. If you know where your arrow's hitting on your 30 yard pin, you know, whether it's 25 or 35, you know, you can get an idea of error calculation.
Oh yeah.
You know, where that's going to hit if you're off by a few yards. And, yeah. My fear is wounding an elk and then having to spend 3 days looking for it. And then, you know, ultimately not finding it.
Yeah. That is, I mean, worst case scenario, right? I mean, that's like, not that wrecks the whole hunt, it wrecks the whole experience. You're going to think about it. I mean, for you, you'll be thinking about it till you get out next, but for us flatlanders, I mean, we're going to think about it the whole year. Like, it's just going to eat at you for a whole year. And we have people in our, we have a guy in our group that did that once, and it bothered him for a long time. And it's funny you say that, because that exact situation happened to me. I had a 6-point bull walk by. I was at very killable. You know, most, you know, experts would have killed that bull 10 times out of 10 times, but I wasn't that confident in the error calculation, in the just picking up a bow and shooting it without the known distance. And I felt like I needed to get this range in so bad that I wasted all my time trying to get a range, and I was shaking and I never got it. And he walked through the opening. And then after it all cooled down, I, you know, ranged it, it was 35 yards. And then that really taught me, like, if this is under 40 yards, you need to be able to kill that bull without your rangefinder. Because you're not always going to have that luxury of pulling it out, having the time. You know, I've noticed it's very hard for me to range when there's a bull, because I'm going like this. It, you know, I'm shaking so bad I can't get a good range. Now I can't even trust it when it goes off. So if it's that close, I really need to be able to know my distances and know how my bow is going to perform, so I don't have to waste that time.
I'm like anybody. I mean, there's a level of arrogance that, you know, I can go out and, you know, I can pull that bow back and I could, you know, I can hit a target at 80, 90, 100 yards. You know, that's great. But I know so many guys that they get so focused on that 50 plus that they don't know what's going to happen inside that 40 yards and they can't get the rangefinder on it. You know, and you know, that's when you shoot over them, you shoot under them, you know, because you don't know what those pins are like. You know, inside of 30 yards, I mean, you can use your 20 yard pin. You just need to know where to aim. So if you're off by 10 yards, you're still going to be in that kill zone.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to be in those vitals.
And it's so important, because the closer you get, the less time you're going to have, the less movement you're going to be able to get away with.
Oh, for sure.
And at a certain point, you just have to have that killer instinct that says, it doesn't matter if this bull's at 32 or 26, I'm going to put my 20 on his lungs and the 40s on his heart, and this bull's going to die.
Exactly. But you've got to know that that's the case.
Yeah.
You know, and that comes through repetition and practice.
Yeah. 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 That's good insight. I wish you would have told me that like 5 years ago, the year before I shot that or missed that shot at a bull, which is so equally frustrating, because like 2 days later, we're walking out of the timber into a meadow, and there's a bull feeding midday at 53 yards. And this opportunity has been eating at me for 2 days now. Everything I messed up. I didn't stop them. I didn't get a range. I was shooting a single ping slider at the time, which is kind of feeding into why I thought I had needed this range. Nothing went to plan. So the second time, I did everything textbook. I knocked my arrow. I think I already had an arrow knocked because we could smell elk. You know, I ranged him 53, dialed to 53, drew back as I stopped him, you know, did the, you know, stop him.
Yeah.
Settle the pin, shot breaks, and there's an explosion about a foot in front of my bow. There was a branch that was so close. It was in front of my arrow, but not in my sight housing. And so when I shot, that tree went wild. I saw my lighted nock just sail way out into Yellowstone. I mean, Yellowstone's 20 miles away, but that's how far I missed this bull by. 30 feet over his back, and the bull just kind of whirls and looks like, what happened? And my brother steps out from behind a tree, just like, you know, Last of the Mohicans, takes an arrow out, pulls back, asks for the range. I'm like 60, shoots it, bull runs 2 miles straight back to the four-wheeler and tips over, and done deal. I'm like, that's just the way this works, I suppose. Did everything right.
Yeah.
Tree jumped out in front of me. Brother gets the bull.
Yep.
So.
Yep, but I mean... Yeah, that's the thing too, is you know, like in that situation, you're hunting as a pair, and you know, you've got first shot. Your brother's not just standing there, you know, with his proverbial you know what in his hand. You know, he's somewhat prepared that if something goes wrong with your shot, he can get that shot off.
Yeah.
And that last bull I killed, You know, he was dead with my arrow, but my brother was, he was kind of down below me. My shot was 30 yards and I think his was like 42 or something from where he was at. But I hit that thing, I hit him, you know, right in the chest, you know, killed him, but he went to stand up and my brother was ready.
Yeah.
And, you know, he threw another arrow up there because he saw him trying to get up and that made a quick track job because he rolled right over in his bed and died right there.
Oh my gosh. That shooting an elk with a bow is, you know, I haven't done it yet. My brother's done it a bunch, but that's going to be right up there. But watching him tip over is going to be like,
yes,
that's the full circle of, you know, because otherwise, like, even if you know you drilled him, but he ran off and you didn't see him tip over, you're still going to be like, what happened? Like, I saw that arrow go in his heart and he ran 100 yards and now I can't see him anymore.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. Well, you know, I had a great time talking to you. I don't want to kind of respect your time, even though you sounds like you got a lot of it, but we are coming up over an hour here. So maybe respect the listener's time. So,
yeah.
Awesome. Give people a chance to follow you along with you. I want you to share your Instagram because it's amazing.
It's my Instagram is 303 Trophy Husband. The outfit, one of the outfitters I worked for down in Colorado, he kind of gave me that one. You know, I was kind of talking to him about. You know, guiding fly fishing for him, and he's like, well, what are you doing right now? Where do you work? And I kind of thought about it for a second, and I said, I'm a trophy husband. And he goes, you're hired.
Which is funny because I think I asked her, I got your Instagram, like day one or two before I kind of knew that you actually were a trophy husband, and my first reaction was like, that doesn't seem to match the guy I just met. Like, that's a very strange Instagram handle. Then I found out, like, no, you know, my wife works full time, so I'm kind of home with the kids, and then I just hunt and fish. And I was like, oh, okay, now it makes sense.
Yeah, get on there, follow me. I'm always, you know, people coming from the, you know, from the Midwest, the South, you know, you want advice on, you know, I'm not going to give you like particular spots, but you know, you want advice on gear that you might want to have, you know, like realistically, you know, there's a lot of opinions out there on gear. People tend to spend a lot more money than they need to, you know, tactics, anything like that. I mean, you can reach out to, I don't post a whole ton, but I'm always, you know, I check my messages, and anybody that's got questions for me, I'm an open book on a lot of stuff. And, you know, I want people to come out here and be successful. I guess I'm kind of in the minority on, you know, the resident hunter. I like to see people come out from out of state. I like meeting people up from out of state and seeing them succeed is, I love it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it's a cool thing to see, to meet people in the hunting community that are like-minded and are helpful and open. I think it's just important, if you're going to be asking those questions, like, learn how to ask good questions. So for example, don't ask, where should I go? Ask, how should I look for a unit?
Right.
And then that gives us or Dwayne or me or anyone, that gives you them more ability to answer your question, because they're not going to give you your spot. Right.
Right.
But then they could say, well, if you're looking for just an experience in seeing elk, you know, look, you know, go to this website and look for, you know, places that are over objective, or look for the kind of terrain that you feel comfortable hunting. Like, this is how I would find a unit. And then that's not only like going to teach you something, but then you're going to be able to do that over and over again. Whereas if Dwayne magically does give you a spot, it's probably a spot he doesn't like and it's not going to go to. But it's only one. Like, that's a one-time thing. Right now, if you go there and it doesn't work, you're still out with anything. If Dwayne teaches you how you can look for a unit, then you can apply that to every hunt.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Learn how to ask good questions. You get a lot more information that way.
Yep.
So, Awesome. Well, thanks for being here, Dwayne. Go check him out, 303 Trophy Husband. Lots of great fly fishing pictures, lots of mule deer, lots of elk. So
hopefully as I start getting back out with the rod, there'll be more fly fishing pictures, but I'm going to try to get out with the camera a little bit more, this spring and early summer too, and see what I can get. I've got some backpacking trips planned. And so I'm going to try to get the camera out a little more and try to get some pictures of some elk and moose and stuff like that going too.
Cool. There it is. Going to be a full service Instagram page.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thanks for being
here. Oh, man.
Thanks for listening.
Good to talk to you.
Yeah. Always reach out anytime.
Yep.